So the general question that I was talking about yesterday is, when you evaluate after suitable regularization and the subtraction of divergences, Feynman integrals in some perturbative expansion of, let's say, scalar, Euclidean, and in most cases massless, and especially massless quantum field theories. When can you interpret the result as a period of some motive or some algebraic variety? And in moreover, what kind of period is it? And in particular, what are the circumstances under which this happens to be of a very special kind, a period of a mixed state motive? And so what I discussed yesterday was the point of view where you write Feynman integrals in momentum space. They end up being integrals over momentum variables and with momentum propagators, nominator, which are these quadratic forms that I talked about yesterday. And what I'm going to do today is focus on the kind of dual picture, which is what happens in configuration space. Hence, the two pictures are clearly, in a sense, Fourier dual of each other. Typically, in the sense that the propagators, I wrote it roughly here, but I'll say it better in a moment, are Fourier transform of each other. However, if you're interested in drawing conclusions about periods, you cannot just wave your hand saying Fourier transform and walk away, because Fourier transform is not an algebraic operation, so it doesn't necessarily preserve any kind of algebra geometric setting you want to put your problem into. And moreover, even if you just bothered about the integral itself, Fourier transform preserves the L2 norm but not the L1 norm, so there's no reason why period would be matched like that. So of course, these pictures under all possible reasonable circumstances are equivalent or should be. So you expect that you will see the same phenomena, but you will see them in a different way because the setting, the geometric setting that things fit in is going to be different. Okay, so this is just a quick reminder from what I already said yesterday. What you mean by a period is a number which is in general transcendental, but which is obtained by integrating an algebraic differential form over a locus which is defined by algebraic equations inside some algebraic variety. And what the geometry of the algebraic variety, especially its motive, which again I'm not going to say much about, but is going to constrain very seriously what kind of numbers can arise as periods over that variety. So one can, in principle, predict what kind of numbers would arise in Feynman integral calculation if you can interpret them as a period of some variety that whose motive you can identify. And since one knows that multiple zeta values are pervasively present in Feynman integral calculation, that leads naturally to the question of trying to understand when the underlying motive in whatever algebra geometric setting you can formulate the Feynman integral calculation into, whether that motive is going to be mixed state or not, because of this general result that I already mentioned yesterday, that the multiple zeta values, or rather linear combinations with rational n powers of 2 pi coefficients of multiple zeta values, are all the possible periods that you can see as periods of mixed state motives. Okay, so yesterday I described a little bit the situation with momentum space and the fact that there are explicit examples of non-mixed state things that arise as soon as the graphs get sufficiently large. So you expect that something like that is going to happen in this other picture as well, which is going to be the case. But we're going to try to see what else one can say from the momentum space that allows you to identify specific things that will look like the mixed state things. Okay, so general setting as before, I'm looking at a scalar field theory. I'm going to assume it's Euclidean, and I will very quickly move on to make it massless as well. And I'm going to focus on this configuration space. And so what I will present as so first of all, let me stress two things. I'm going to talk about, in fact, two different problems, which look very similar. The reason why I think this is an interesting thing to look at is that you can look at two problems that are in a sense that I'll make more precise in a moment. One of them can be thought of as a kind of complexification of the other one. But you know, they actually lead to naturally very different mathematical methods to look at them. And they will also lead to different behavior from the point of view of what kind of periods and so on you can get. And one of them, the one that I call the real case, is really the one that kind of corresponds to the Feynman amplitudes of a scalar quantum field theory formulated in configuration space. The other one is kind of a, if you want, it's a mathematical abstraction of the same problem that is kind of a complexification of that. And as I said, the reason why I want to consider both of them is precisely because they lead, one can see two different sets of methods that one can apply to this case and can see two different behaviors. And so from the algebra geometric perspective, which will actually mostly apply to the second case, the kind of situation, the geometry we're going to look at is different from the geometry that I talked about yesterday. Here we're going to have, well, some complexification of the you know, flat space. So there's going to be an affine space in D dimension. D is the space, which is Euclidean, so it's a space-time dimension. And we're going to just embed that into some algebraic variety. So you pick your favorite algebraic variety that contain a copy of a fine space. For example, P, projected space, PD. And it could be something else. And then you know, when you look at configurations of points, you know, you're looking at a product of this variety with a number of copies equal to the number of vertices of the graph. And you know that, you know, what's going to happen, I haven't yet written what how you build the Feynman amplitudes in this case, but what will happen is that will be defined away from the places where these points collide. So it's really going to be defined on what is called the configuration, the configuration space. Well, we're really looking at a family of configuration spaces that depend on the graph. And these are the complement in this product of all the diagonals given by, you know, where two of the coordinates collide, that are the two endpoints on one of the edges of the graph. So you're only looking at diagonals that correspond to the edges of the graph. That's why it depends on the choice of the graph. And the interesting part of the story, which I'll come back to in a little later in the talk, is that these are interesting algebraic varieties. So this is obviously not compact, because you're removing all these diagonals. And of course, you can compactify it just by going back to just this product, but that's not interesting. But there's another compactification which is much more interesting, which is called the wonderful compactification. And that's the one that we're going to look at, which basically allows you to separate the points of the diagonals in a suitable way and go to some larger space where you keep them apart. OK, so what are we looking at? What kind of integral are we looking at? So as I said, there are two problems. So the differential form I'm looking at is slightly different in the two problems. So I'm just for convenience write the space-time dimension as 2 lambda plus 2. I'm in some even dimensional case. And one way in what I call the real case, my first case I'll be looking at, I just write the differential form in this way. It's a product of the edges. And then you have this Euclidean norm of the difference of the coordinates at the two endpoints to a power which depends on the dimension. And then you have just the volume form. Okay. And this is a smooth differential form. It's obviously not an algebraic differential form because you have the Euclidean norm involved there. And it has singularities along the diagonals. That's where the norm vanishes. So moreover, not only is not an algebraic form, you see yesterday, everything that I talked about relied on the fact that I was using algebraic differential forms. Here, I'm not using algebraic differential forms. And moreover, I'm using a form that's not closed. You could take the differential, you see that, you know, it's easy to see that it's not a closed form. And, you know, well, what's good about closed forms is that they really are cohomology classes, and you pretty much don't care about the form itself. you only care about its class, so you're free to trade it with another form as long as you stay within the same cohomology class. And that's going to work. That's the trick that's going to work well for my other complexified problem. But for this one, I cannot do any sort of tricks by changing the form. I'm just going to stick to this form and use it as it is. And no, so I point out that these are two kind of issues that I need to work with in order to get things that will actually give me interesting.
You're saying it's not closed because it has problems. It's a top degree form, it's a top degree form as a polymorphic form.
Right. So, that's the point. Yeah, you'll see in a moment the difference between the other with this and the other case where it will actually be really, a top form. But so this one is that's going to be the differential form, and the chain of integration is going to be the real points of this. Of this space. So of course, there's going to be a volume form on this, but it's as in the larger space, it's not close. And version two, what I mean by complexification is that now I just do an exercise and try to cook up a problem that's similar to the one that I just described, but I just decide to double the number of variables. That's what I mean by complexifying the picture. And make a form that is now a top form in this space and is now manifestly closed. It's a closed form. You see the rest is not changed much. I mean, I had to slightly adjust the exponent. So I mean the rest is pretty much the same form, except that I'm now the domain of integration is the complexified version of the one that I had before. So I now want to integrate a form of the right degree over here, and that's why I take the natural form that allows me to do that.
But the propagators you've got there, that's a holomorphic propagator, apart from its poles.
Yeah, so let me comment in a moment on the propagators in these two cases and why I'm writing them that way. But so it's still not an algebraic form, so I've not changed that part of the situation, but now it is a closed form, so they are different in this way. Now let me comment on the propagators. So I'm writing them this way because they are actually respectively the green functions of the real Laplacian in the first case and the green function of the complex Laplacian in the second case. So I'm cooking it up so that it's really, in a sense, the analog when you complexify everything inside. That's okay. So what is the relation to momentum space? So this is why I said that the first case is really the one that corresponds to the physical case that I discussed yesterday. So yesterday we saw the propagators in momentum space. So where's the ones that we're looking at? And I'll come back in a moment to comment on the fact that now I'm writing it with the Euclidean norm there, where yesterday I wrote it with the quadratic polynomial. Of course, on the real momenta, that doesn't change anything, but on the complex ones, it does. But anyway, let me write it like this, and I'll make a comment in a moment of what I just said in a more precise way. But so you have indeed that what corresponds to the momentum space propagator when you pass to configuration space is, well, either what I just used to build my form in the massless case. So that's what I'm going to restrict to the massless case by making this choice. And if you also want to keep the mass case present, what would correspond to that propagator is something where you need to correct this expression by some Bessel functions. And I will not discuss this today. I mean, we discussed it in one of the papers, so what you can do with that. But for today, I'm really going to stick to this case. So everything is going to be for the massless case. Yes?
Could you remind what the integration of the complex domain? Could you remind how the integration of over complex domains has come about?
Yeah, so the integration, no, as you can see, you know, when I say that this one is the chain of integration, naturally you're going to have divergences to deal with at some point, and you know, I'll come back to that later on. But
integration of a contour and a complex domain.
Yeah, so I have a form of a certain degree. I want to integrate it on a subvariety of my ambient space, which is of the dimension that matches the degree. Now that integral might converge or not converge, and that's something else. But I'm not discussing it for now.
Where did EX bar come from? So what is the origin of EX?
Yeah, I have a copy of a fine space inside there. Right? So I'm coordinatizing that copy.
Is this omega z, is that a real, is that a smooth real form?
This is just a smooth differential form. It's not a holomorphic form.
Real.
It is smooth away from the diagonals. That's why, you know, I'm gonna. It has singularities on the diagonals. So that's what I know. What I have. That's, you know.
But is it real? Is it a real form?
Yeah.
Okay. So the denominator, the propagator.
So
is,
I mean,
real.
Here, when I restrict it to here, it's just a real form, right?
So my concern is about the propagator. I don't understand the notation, whether it's real or complex value.
I have a complex affine space.
Yeah.
Where I'm writing the norm, I mean, my coordinates are in this complex affine space.
Yeah.
Leave aside for the moment whether I compactify it to something else, but it's complex affine space, and I have in particular, it's real points inside which are a real affine space. So when I restrict to that, I just get a real form, which is smooth and it's of top degree on that subspace. And you know, that's what the part that matters for the integral. You know, I'm just conveniently placing it inside some complex. Right? But that's, you know, in the end here. You know, here is something else because my domain of integration is a complex space, and I have a complex, you know, form which is a smooth differential form over this complex space.
Okay. In the first formula, in the denominator, is the norm,
right?
Is that a real norm or is it a complex norm?
No, it is the Hermitian norm on C to the N, on C to the D times number of vertices of.
The dx bar, is that just the coordinate on the second copy of x, or is it the complex conjugate?
Yeah, so the x bar is the complex. So I mean, if you don't like the notation in coordinates, I mean, it's just a volume form over the affine space in here, in this space. Okay. So, you know, the reason why these two match when m is equal to zero in passing from momentum to configuration space is indeed via a Fourier transform. So the propagators are really, you know, Fourier transformed to each other. And however, you know, this, as I said, works for the first case that I'm talking about. This sort of complexification case is a slight, you know, abstraction of the first problem, which I'm doing for comparison reasons. So let me comment on this thing of the smooth form versus algebraic form. So when I talked about the momentum space picture yesterday, what I did was to write the propagators in the denominator not using norms. I wrote them as quadratic forms in the momentum variables. And you know, when these momenta are real, you know, this doesn't matter. So it restricts to what you want anyway on the physical parts of the picture. But you have two possible choices of how you extend it when you complexify the coordinates. One of them allows you to keep things algebraic, and the other one makes them smooth, non-algebraic. And you know, what is the advantage? So obviously having, so this is the corresponding picture with coordinate space. So you could, instead of taking the norms, you could define a quadratic form in the coordinates. But so this would give you the advantage that you replicate what I was doing in momentum space. You work with algebraic differential forms, which looks good if you want to try to do things that have to do with algebraic geometry. On the other hand, it reproduces the same problem that I was talking about yesterday, that the place where this denominator vanishes is a certain, you know, algebraic variety, and then you need to control that variety. So you need to control the motive of that variety, and there's going to be certain quantities that intersect in certain ways, which somehow are not necessarily easy to control. So what I want to do is I don't want to exactly replicate the same features and bugs that I talked about in the momentum space picture. I want to do something else. I want to try a different way, which is to actually choose not to, you know, use the algebraic differential forms. What will happen? So, what is the advantage? So, what is the disadvantage? Is clear that, you know, I don't have an algebraic differential form, so I will have to justify somehow that whatever numbers I get down the line are going to be interpretable as periods. But what I get as an advantage is that now the singular locus is very easy to control. It's just a union of diagonals. So those are things that are much easier than these quadrics. Okay, so now let me come to the two different problems. So the first one, what I'm going to do is, so the first one I'm going to try to deal with in purely analytically as approach. And because, okay, I have to deal with this fact that the form is not algebraic, and it's also not closed, so I cannot try to trade it with another form in the same cohomology class. So I'm just going to try to do a brute force analytic approach, which is to try to expand it out into something that that I can try to compute. So there's a story which is actually an old story, which has been, you know, if you dig in the physics literature, it's been there for a long time, and which is the fact that you can expand the Green function of the Laplacian into orthogonal polynomials. There's a nice family of orthogonal polynomials into which you can expand the Green function of the Laplacian, and so we're going to do that. And we'll see that you do see some multiple zeta values appearing in that way. And in the end, what this approach leads to, it allows you to identify one piece of the Feynman integral calculation, which is in this configuration. I don't know what that corresponds to in the picture in momentum space, because I don't have a similar characterization there. But in this configuration space story, it's completely characterized in representation theoretic terms. It will be a certain contribution from the SOD representation. And that term will always contribute mixed state, will always contribute multiple zeta values, or things that are expressible in terms of multiple zeta values, even when you know that the graph becomes large enough that you expect to see things that are not multiple zeta values. So you kind of identify something that will always maintain that property, even though you will have other terms that you cannot control. So that's the best you can get to this method, and then I'll talk about the other method. And the other method, let me anticipate for a moment what that would be. So the other method, the other problem, I'm going to approach it with a completely different point of view, which is that, okay, I know the form is not algebraic, but I know it's closed. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull all the problem up into this nice compactification of configuration space. And there, I'm going to trade this form for another one in the same cohomology class, which is algebraic. And then I'm going to interpret what I get as periods, because then I can play the usual game of algebraic differential forms on algebraic varieties. And what I find out from this point of view is that in this case, you always end up with a motive that's mixed state. Although, I mean, it's not necessarily mixed state over Z or even over Q. So, you know, there's some complication going on here. But it's, so in this sense, the two problems are different, because the first problem, you know that you will run into things that are not mixed state, but the second one leads you to something naturally that's mixed state. So they look very similar when you state them in the beginning, but they branch out into interesting differences later on, which shows in a way that, you know, these problems are a little bit subtle, you know, in the sense that when you see it, two things can look very similar, but they can lead to results that are quite different. So, let's get down to the first case. So, how am I going to do that? So, first of all, I want to decompose. So, the chain of integration is just, as I said, these real points of this variety that some compactification of a fine space, you know, taken to a power that's the number of vertices. So that's fine. I mean, that's okay. But I want to decompose that into things that look like simplices, and the reason for that is because at some point down the line, I want to end up with something that looks like a multiple polylog or integrated on a simplex, because I know that that will give multiple zeta values or something that's expressible in terms of multiple zeta values. So I want to decompose in some nice way my domain of integration into a collection of chains that look like simplices. And one way to do that, since everything depends on the graph, one way to do that is to construct such a decomposition based on, one way to do it is based on spanning trees in the graph. Another way to do it is based on partial orderings of the vertices of the graph, so acyclic orientations of the graph. So it's not so important except for one thing, that, okay, what I do in the end is to, so one another thing I want to do, that's why I'm breaking down the domain of integration like this, is to separate out a part that only involves the radial. So I'm going to write everything in polar coordinates on this big affine space. And I want to separate out a part of the integral that only depends on the radial coordinates, and the part that is a bunch of spheres, which are the angle coordinates. The reason for that is what I just said. I'm going to expand things in spherical polynomials, and so I want to have integrals on spheres where spherical polynomials are nice, and then reduce the radial coordinates to integrals along simplices on which, you know, then I hope to get out the kind of periods that I want. Okay, so what is this Gegenbauer polynomial business? So the basic thing is that you have a certain family of orthogonal polynomials, which again depends on a parameter lambda. For us, lambda is related to the dimension of the underlying spacetime. And their generating function of this family of orthogonal polynomial is this quadratic form, which you can read as, so you can use that generating function, well, plus you know that they are orthogonal with respect to a certain specific norm. And you can use that fact to obtain an expansion of the Green functions of the Laplacian in terms of a part that involves the radial. And so here the notation, I'm just using two different radial coordinates for the source and target points. So I hope it's not too confusing. But anyway, this involves only the radial coordinates of these two points, and then you have a term that involves the angle coordinates. And so what comes up when you use that expansion is you're going to have these spherical polynomials, these orthogonal polynomials in the angle, only in the angle variables. And you're going to have something which only has the radial variables. And the radial variables are coming into a power series. That's what's going to, in the end, come into the variable. This, in the end, at the end of the day, these are going to be the function, the powers of that enter in the polylog function. And this part is going to provide the coefficients of the polylog function. Okay, so let me say one more nice property, which is quite useful, that these Gegenbauer polynomials have. They are actually related to a basis of an orthonormal basis of the space of spherical harmonics on the sphere of a given degree. And so you can actually, so there's something called the zonal spherical harmonics, which are these sums of spherical harmonics. And when you sum over an orthonormal basis for fixed degree, and the Gegenbauer polynomials are just multiples of these spherical harmonics, where the coefficient only depends on the volume of the sphere and some numbers that depend on the degree of the spherical harmonics and the dimension. And so the one thing is that what I'm going to do in this case really relies on the fact that you are in dimension 4. Because in dimension 4, a lot of this story simplifies very nicely. And the dimension of the space of spherical harmonics is just going to be a square of n plus 1. And if you compute this coefficient, well, you get some powers of pi, but then you also get something which is, again, a power of n plus 1. And those are going to, in the end, become these powers of n in the polylog function that I'm going to see. So it really works in dimension 4. You know, the same argument would not directly generalize to other dimensions. But so what I'm doing by using my decomposition of the domain of integration and using this expansion in Gegenbauer polynomial of the differential form, I'm going to repackage the integral that I was trying to compute into a sum of integrals where I can deal separately with an integral that only involves the angle coordinates, the points on the, so it only involves an integral on a product of spheres. And then I can use these as coefficients for a function that only depends on the radial variables and which I then have to integrate on these chains, which are combination of simplices. So the issue boils down to how you're going to deal with these angular integrals for a given graph. So this has a lot of information about how the graph is put together in it, because you have a product of edges, and then you have pairing of variables depending on the two ends of the edge. So it's what combinations of this Gegenbauer polynomial you get. It really depends on the combinatorics of the graph. So you're going to have to try to think about how to deal with these integrals. First, those go as coefficients of the other function that you're integrating next. So you need to somehow deal with that first. So let me just pick a very simple example. Let's just look at the polygon. And so what happens with the polygon? Well, with the case of a polygon, the nice thing is that you only have, one, so you have just a chain of edges. So these coefficients you can compute directly, and so you can compute explicitly everything, and you just get these angular integrals at these numbers. And of course, when you are in dimension 4, this simplify and you just get some powers of n, 1 over n to some power. And it actually, the power is k minus 2. So you get that in this case, you are integrating, you're clearly integrating a polylog over a simplex. And in that case, you get an actual zeta value. It's not a multiple zeta value. So but you can see already that the case of a polygon is not so, it's straightforward, but it's not so totally immediately clear. So it's obvious that things get complicated very quickly. But so what can you do with a more complicated graph? So the thing is, the trouble comes from the fact that whenever, so what is it that makes things work for the polygon? It's the fact that at each vertex, you only have one incoming edge and one outgoing edge. So you have a product of two Gegenbauer polynomials integrated over the same variable. And you can use the orthogonality relation and get down to something that's just one constant in the end, which is this normalization factor that you compute. So the problem is, the more interesting problem is coming when you have vertices that are at least trivalent, because you're going to have products of three Gegenbauer polynomials integrated over the same variable, which means products of three harmonics on the sphere integrated over the same variable. So triple products of harmonics on the sphere. And in fact, using, again, the orthogonality relation, you can show that if you have vertices that are higher valence, you can always reduce it to the case of trivalent vertices. So the key issue is what you do with a trivalent vertex. So what you do with the triple products of harmonic functions integrated over the same variable. And this is a well-known problem with harmonic analysis, and in fact there are specific coefficients that exactly compute that, the product of three spherical harmonics integrated over the same variable. They are the isoscalar factors, and these depend. So the point is that there's some recursive formula for these isoscalar factors, which reduce the case of d dimension to the case of d minus one dimension, and in the end, and they depend on specific representation theoretic data on the momentum representation, so the point is that these are completely explicit, and there are explicit formula for computing them, but this formula is very complicated. But there's one thing you can do, which is, this already organizes all the terms in a kind of hierarchical structure, which is determined by this data of the representation, of the SOD representation. So you can pick like the deepest representation in this thing, which is the one that has all these variables equal to zero, and it only has the n. And just focus on the contribution of that term. So it's like, in a sense, the leading term, and then you have all the other ones. And so that's the one that I'm going to focus on, and that's the one that I claim will always give you something which is expressible in terms of multiple zeta values. The rest, I don't know. In fact, the rest will not, because, we know that some point down the line you will find things that are not multiple zeta values, so at least, somewhere you will have other things that are not multiple zeta values, but at least this allows you to identify one term that stays, which doesn't, I don't know what kind of description you can give of it in the momentum space picture. Okay, so let me just skip on the sort of there's a little bit of messy calculation still even for that term. So you have to input these coefficients in the picture and compute these angular integrals and then compute these radial integrals. But let me tell you what the outcome is. So the outcome is that you can repackage the form that you're integrating over, in terms. So that what you do is you look at the contribution of each star of a trivalent vertex, and then you start matching variables whenever you put together two edges, and you integrate over that. And so the result is that the functions that you're integrating are generalizations of the polylog functions, and the corresponding integrals over simplices are generalization of the corresponding polylogs and multiple polylog functions. They are generalization of the corresponding zeta values and multiple zeta values, which are well known. They are generalizations that have already been studied in the literature. They are these model Thornheim multiple series and Apostol-Wu multiple series. And these are known to be expressible as combinations of multiple zeta values. So the outcome is you do get something that at the end of the story you can identify as belonging to the class of numbers that are periods of mixed modius. Okay, so conclusion for this approach is that you can see explicit integrals that correspond to a contribution of one particular term in this expansion spherical harmonics, which corresponds to the deepest term in the SOD representation data, which always leads to certain terms that are combinations of multiple zeta values. Of course, this doesn't tell you anything about what occurs in the other terms, which might be whatever it might be. And it's really messy to try to compute it explicitly. So if anybody is happy to do that, it won't be me. Okay.
So when you identify some part of the computation which involves the mixed state motive.
Right, so I cannot tell you the motive explicitly. I can just tell you that the number belongs to the right class of periods.
So perhaps that already answers the question, but let me ask it anyway. Right. So. Does it mean when you find this component, which is mixed state, does that mean that in the configuration space you see a subvariety which is like the configuration space of two endpoints on P1?
Right. So in morally, yes, but I cannot tell you this is the motive. What I can tell you is you have this function that you're integrating, which is like a polylog function or generalization of polylog. So motives have several manifestations. One of them is Hodge structures, which is sort of the analytic side of motives. And polylogs and multiple polylogs are, in particular, Hodge structures of certain mixed state motives. So one way of seeing the motive is through whatever generalization or combinations of, these kind of series that are like polylog and multiple polylog series. So that's maybe one way of thinking of what is the motive. But I cannot, in this case, give you the motive as a subvariety of the configuration space.
But from this point of view, is it true that the complexity of the configuration space of graphs is really the source of all of the difficulty?
So the thing is, the problem is that this approach is really not very geometric, in the sense that you're just analytically computing these integrals and then sort of staring at what you get and try to read it as some kind of, that's why I think the way to read the motive might be better from the sort of more analytic point of view on motives, which is identifying these functions that are, and so in a sense, I don't know where to come up with the actual variety that would correspond to that motive. In the sense, that's why these two pictures are quite different, because now I'm going to say for this other complexified version, it will be much easier to see the geometry in that case, but it's not the same geometry that corresponds to the other case. So, yeah. Okay, so let me now rewind a little bit and look at the other version of the problems that I discussed, this complexified problem. And I said that I'm going to try to treat with a different point of view. So I'm not going to try to explicitly compute the integral. I'm going to try to put the integral computation in some place where I can trade the differential, the closed but not algebraic differential form with something else in the same cohomology class that will be algebraic and that will be nice, more controllable. And so in this case, I really do care about setting up the geometry in some nice way. So let me come back to where we are. So let me remind you of this general fact. So if you have a smooth projective variety, and we're going to pick one that contains a dense affine space, which is our physical space or complexified physical space. And we want to interpret the form that we're trying to compute as a form on this variety. And actually, it's going to be the form on, so this product of copies of this variety given by the number of vertices of the graph. And this is going to have singularities along the diagonal, and of course there's also this compactification, this divisor at infinity of the compactification that I'm choosing, where there will be other singularities. And so what I'm looking at is this configuration space, which is the space where I remove all the diagonals from this product space. And as I said, there is a, so why do I want to construct some interesting compactification of this space? So I said, okay, I already had one and I'm removing something and then I'm putting in something else. So the idea is, so that there's one algebra geometric properties that I want to get to. So if I have a variety which is not compact, but it happens to be the complement of a normal crossing divisor, then it has one nice property in particular, that its cohomology, it's always computed by algebraic differential forms with logarithmic poles along the components of the divisor. And that's going to be nice because logarithmic poles are something that they have residues, so there's some way that I can subtract poles or something like that. So the forms with logarithmic poles are nice. That's the bottom line. I'm going to say, so if I'm looking at this space here, well, I have a form that I begin with, it's not algebraic, and it's also singular along something which is of varying codimension. I mean, these diagonals are not hypersurfaces. These diagonals have higher codimension. And so I'm not gonna, I don't wanna work in here by, I don't want to view this, so of course I want to work in here because that's where my form lives, but I don't want to view this as the complement of this guy. Because this guy is not nice enough to have, to allow me to find a nice form. I want to realize the same variety as the complement of something which is a normal crossing divisor. So that's what a lot of these compactifications in algebraic geometry do for you. So like, I don't know, if you have the plane and you remove a point, you have something that's a codimension two things. But now if you blow up that point, you have the complement of a divisor, which is nicer. So if you think of it as the complement of a point, it's not clear that you can replace an algebraic form by something that is logarithmic poles, because it's just a codimension two thing. But if you blow it up, then in the complement is isomorphic. That's a nice thing of blow-ups, that they don't touch anything on the complement, so you're still working with the same open variety, but you're replacing the boundary or whatever you removed, you're replacing it with something nicer. When that something nicer is made of divisors. And that's so the codimension one things, and if you can put it in a way that it's a normal crossing divisor, they also intersect very nicely, it's the best possible case that you can have for a cohomology of algebraic varieties. So that's why I want to do this. So I want to replace thinking of this as the complement of this guy with thinking of this as the complement inside something else of something nice, which is a normal crossing divisor. Okay, I'm gonna have to do a little bit of a change it because I did this for X. As I said, what I did in this problem was doubling the variables of so I'm really gonna do it for one side where my chain of integration lives of a product. But I mean, this is just silly things. The main idea is what I said a moment ago. Okay, so what happens is that you have a projection map from the compactification to your initial configuration space. So if you have a differential form, the differential form you start with, you can pull it back to this nice compactification, and then you can reformulate the calculation of the integral in this nicer place. So by the way, I should say that these compactifications are a generalization of this very famous Fulton-McPherson compactifications of configuration spaces, which really just correspond to the complete graph. And so these other ones depend on the graph. They are pretty much constructed in the same way as the Fulton-McPherson compactification. And there's a nice way of describing them as an iterated sequence of blow-ups on the variety that you start with. So before you subtract the diagonals, you take this product, and now you blow up the diagonals in some order, and you get this compactification of the configuration space. And it's this fact, this description as iterated blow-ups, that allows you to conclude that you get this nice normal crossing divisor. So this is kind of part of a very nice very general construction. There are other such compactifications that work for arrangements of subvarieties. There are these De Concini, Procesi, wonderful compactifications, and these are actually special cases of that very general story. Okay, so let me not get too much in the details. So this is actually, there's some details about like how you have to order the diagonal in order to perform these blow-ups and what happens. So, but let me just skip on this. You have which family of diagonals exactly you have to blow up and so on. But so everything is very explicit, and you just have to keep track of some combinatorial things to do it right. I'm not getting too much in the details. But I mean, the outcome is that the new compactification is the boundary, so what you're adding to compactify is this nice normal crossing divisor, and you can control exactly when the components intersect in terms of how the graphs are the subgraphs of the original graph are nested into one another and so on. So what about the motive now? Now this is the place where you are. So this is the place where now this period calculation is going to take place, And I haven't yet said what you do with the differential form, but since this is the ambient space, and I want to say, I want to try to check what the motive of this variety that I just constructed is. And again, this is something, there's not this nice fact that blow-ups are very well behaved with respect to motives. So there are some very nice formulae for the motive of a blow-up, which basically tells you that it's like, the thing is that the exceptional divisor of the blow-up is really a projective bundle over what you're blowing up, provided it's smooth. And so, and the projective bundle from the point of view of motives behaves like a product. And so the motive actually decomposes as a sum of pieces because the projective space is a sum of pieces and which are like powers of the Lesch's motive. And so you have a bunch of copies. So the saying is that the motive of a blow up is very easy to control, both at the level, so not just at the level of the Grothendieck class, but even at the level of the actual objects in the category of motives, which are usually more complicated, it really is a sum even there. So there are no non-trivial extensions. It just behaves very nicely. So you apply it to this sequence of blow-ups that determines this wonderful compactification. And you get a somewhat messy, in terms of the number of terms that you have, but you get a completely explicit formula for the motive, which is just a sum of pieces. And so if you know the variety you started with is a Tate motive, so take a projective space, for example, as your compactification of fine space, there's nothing which is more a Tate motive than projective space. And so you will get everything, you will get a nice Tate motive as what you have here. Okay, so yes. So,
it doesn't see the structure of the normal bundle.
No, that's right. So that's right. So that's one sort of now the thing. See, if you give me an arbitrary vector bundle, of course you don't expect that the motive would be a product because motive is like cohomology and you have a Nesser exact sequence. So there would be a long exact sequence, but it would not be split. It would not be a sum. But for projective a projective bundle is really a sum. So I mean, if I give you what I'm saying, or a vector bundle, or in this case a projective bundle. So if I give you a bundle in the sense of a bundle where the fiber is some variety or some other, then you don't expect that it will be. So there are conditions under which it is a product if there are some nice or motivic cell decomposition, and so there are conditions under which even more general bundles can be products. But in general, it will not be. But for projective bundles, it actually is. It doesn't see the non-trivial part of the bundle. So that's a very useful thing for all this blow-up construction. That whenever you can construct something as blow-ups over smooth loci, you have a very good control over what happens with the motive.
And in order to have the motive, it's enough to have the space, or do you also need the differential form as the pair of the motive, or is it only the space?
Right, so this is what I have for the space, and now I'm going to start to see what I do with the form. So but the first thing I do is I pull back the differential form to this compactification using the projection of the blow up. So I have a form up there, and because the form downstairs was singular along the diagonal, the form upstairs is singular along this divisor, which is now the boundary of the compactification. So I have a form on this on this wonderful compactification, which has singularities along a normal crossing divisor. And the chain of integration I also lifted it up. So I reformulate my problem as a problem in this compactification, in this wonderful compactification. So now, okay, that's why I did all these gymnastics. Now I invoke a few properties of the complement of a normal crossing divisor in an algebraic variety. So number one, every cohomology class can be realized by algebraic differential forms. And number two, I can pick them that are forms with logarithmic poles along the components of the divisor. So now I throw away the form that I have in the sense that all I care for is this cohomology class. And I know that inside the cohomology class, I can trade it with a form that is not just algebraic, but it's also with logarithmic poles. So here is where I'm using the fact that the form is closed in this case, and I couldn't do it with the other case because I want to invoke cohomology results. So, okay, now everything is fine because I end up with a form with logarithmic poles, algebraic. However, there's one observation that, you know, the motive itself, so these varieties are varieties over Q, and these blow-ups, they also are varieties over Q. But when I'm doing this trading of the differential form, it may be over some larger field. I mean, so I look more closely at what actually is the shape of this form with logarithmic poles more explicitly, you know, and, you know, I cannot, you know, guarantee that the form itself, I know it will be algebraic, but it can be algebraic over some larger field than Q. Okay. Still, it would be a period in the sense of algebraic geometry, whatever I end up computing. But I still have a problem, like, because, okay, this form still has poles along these divisors, the components of the divisor. So I have to do something to regularize with this integral that I want to compute. And so now, I mean, I'm guaranteed that whatever reasonable way I'm going to use to regularize this integral is going to give me a period. But no, I still have to say what I'm doing to regularize this integral. And the thing is that now you have a few choices of things that all of them seem reasonable things to do, but they are actually different. So, you know, they give you different ways in which to extract an actual period from this integral. So I'm going to sketch, you know, three possible things that you can think of doing to regularize this integral. So one is more analytic, and it relies on the fact that for poles with forms with logarithmic poles have residues, and they have actually iterated residues. So your normal crossing divisor has components that are codimension one. These have intersections, and the intersection, they have higher codimensional thing. So you're going to have residues over everything, over the component. You iterate the residues over the strata with that. So while that one direction of how to think about regularizing this integral is going to have to do with this theory of residues and something that's called principal value currents. And there's another point of view, which is staying more within the algebraic geometry setting, which is, you know, I have, again, what I want to do is separate the locus of divergences from the singularity, separate the chain of integration from the singularities of the form. And I cannot do it in there because they are actually, you know, in the same place. But so one thing I can do is, so in algebraic geometry, but in differential geometry, you would say, I take a tubular neighborhood of the place where I'm integrating, and I move it along somewhere. I push it out on the tubular neighborhood and separate it from the. Take a tubular neighborhood of where the codimension one thing which is codimension two in a real sense, where the form is singular, and where the chain of integration wherever it intersects that, I push it off along the normal direction. I cannot do that in an algebra geometric way because the normal, you know, the tubular neighborhood as such is not defined in algebra geometric sense. But there's a construction in algebraic geometry which is called the deformation to the normal cone, which is exactly meant to supply for the lack of tubular neighborhoods in algebraic geometry. And so I can use that and use that to exactly do what I just said. Let me come back to that in a moment, right? So there's a third possible thing that I can do, which is a pole subtraction on the form itself. So the form has logarithmic poles, and if I have a reasonable way to subtract poles on the form, which is consistent with the graphs, and how, you know, subdivergences and so on happen in smaller graphs, then I can subtract poles on the forms and then integrate. This is obviously not going to give me the same results. So I'm just saying that there are all ways in which you can extract a period from these divergent integrals and they in a way that is meaningful and is compatible with the combinatorics of the graphs, but they don't give you the same answer because they are different procedures from a geometric point of view. So it's this in a sense that it's this is not the same physical problem anyway, but still that whenever you set up these problems in a geometric way, these problems of identifying in with periods, and you want to regularize this integral, usually the geometry suggests some ways of doing that, but these ways are not a priori necessarily equivalent. And so then you think which ones would be relevant in an actual physical situation and which one would be other methods that are mathematically interesting but not necessarily coming from the physics.
Question.
Yes.
Is that how people think about it, or is it not?
That's one way. Yeah, that's one. Yeah. In a sense, right? You are pairing, a relative cohomology class with some. So you are sort of in a Poincaré duality. In this relative to this boundary divisor in some way, but I mean that.
I'm just wondering if these procedures are somehow just used as a method, or if they are used to make a definition of a homology theory.
Yeah. So okay, that might depend on the point of view, but in a sense, what I'm trying to explore is some kind of what are sort of interesting general procedures that allow you to take this type of problems where you have this sort of amplitude which can come in this case from green functions of Laplacians, or you can think of other generalizations of that have a similar flavor, and you want to somehow use geometric methods to extract finite answers that can be interpreted as periods of some interesting varieties and motives. So, in a sense, when this is one perspective, I mean, I'm saying that you can have a more narrowly focused perspective where you say I just want the actual physical amplitude and see what is the actual Feynman integral. But in a sense, you can also take that as a case in a larger setting of problems where you have similar kind of forms that are built out of the combinatorics of the graphs and out of some propagators certain differential operators like Laplacian and so on, and try to see what are general procedures with which you can geometrize these problems and turn them into periods of some interesting motives. And what in that sense, it makes sense to look for what are actually different possible regularization procedures that will lead to ways of thinking of extracting periods from this kind of integral problems. So of course you can have different perspectives on this kind of problems. So I'm not saying this is, but it's the one that I'm sort of pursuing in this type of work.
These are alternatives to dimensional regularization that a field theorist might use.
Right. So I haven't actually said what dimensional regularization corresponds to in this case. Uh-huh. And so these are a little bit more like cutoff kind of regularization, right? Because I'm in a sense I'm really thinking of cutting off a neighborhood of the singular locus. And then regularize in some way, regularizing the limit. So if you do this, there is this current principal value, current regularization, which really is taking this integral is taking you can formulate it in a current distributional sense. And regularize, and it's really using a tubular neighborhood of the divisors, and then letting the radius of the tubular neighborhood go to zero and pick the principal value part. So it's really more like the cutoff regularization in that sense. And this, if you, so the thing is that this one you can interpret. So if you say, if like I just said it with this radius of the tubular neighborhood going to zero is this analytic, you know, distributional way of thinking about taking the principal value, but you can also reformulate it in terms of iterated residues. So basically, what you do is, you know, you have, the point is that you have a, if you do this kind of regularization, you have an ambiguity on the value you get, which is due to the fact that you could go around the component of the divisor and pick up a residue when you do that. So you have multiples of all these residues taken into account in this regularization. Well, let me just very briefly say what is other one. So this deformation to the normal cone, in a sense, is still kind of a cutoff regularization, but where now you don't use tubular neighborhoods because you just want to only use the algebraic analog of a tubular neighborhood, and so that this is this normal cone construction. So the thing is, you want to, you know, say, you know, if you. Since if you want to separate the singularity locus from the chain of integration, what you can do is push one off along this deformation, this algebra geometric deformation, and do it is sort of in an algebraic way so that the you know you get a convergent thing. So let me skip a bit on details, but so I mean you can you, let me may say just one last thing, which is the last approach I mentioned, where I said you could also just try to do a pole subtraction directly on the form and then integrate that. And again, you will have to, in order not to lose too much information when you do that, you'll have to also keep into account residues again along the components of the divisors. So you want to do that in a way that's compatible with subgraphs and so on. So there's a general method for doing these kind of things, which is, you know, to organize all the graphs in a Hopf algebra structure where subgraphs and quotient graphs are the co-product, the Hopf algebra. So this keeps track of the combinatorics of how subgraphs and quotient graphs are, you know, arranged in a graph. And you have another operation, which is a pole subtraction operation. So you think of, you know, this general abstract approach to subtraction of divergences as a procedure that maps graphs, so elements of this Hopf algebra, to something. Now, here will be differential forms. In general, it's something else. It's some power series or something in dimensional regularization, for example. But here it will just be differential forms with logarithmic poles. And then you do a pole subtraction in a way that's compatible with, simultaneously compatible with all the subgraphs. And this is, there's a general algebraic procedure for carrying that out that has to do with using the coproduct of the Hopf algebra and using some properties of this pole subtraction operator, which are called the Rota-Baxter algebra of weight minus one. So this is a very general package that was first developed in the Kohn-Kreimer version of renormalization. It has been abstracted in other settings. And it's just a machine that produces a pole subtraction organized according to subgraphs in a nice way. So you know, what you can do is look at, you know, the geometry that we have. We have this variety with a normal crossing divisor. We have a form with logarithmic poles, and we have also the information about what are all the residues of this form along all the divisor and the components of the divisor and their intersections. So what we're going to do is assemble the, define a pole subtraction operator on this algebra of forms with logarithmic poles, which satisfies these Rothe-Baxter properties. And then we perform a pole subtraction using this general procedure of this algebraic renormalization way. So the what you do in this, what you obtain is a form which is now is now really holomorphic. So that it does you have removed the pole, but you keep the so that basically what you do is you remove it, but you in a way that counts contributions from all the subgraphs in a suitable way, and that gives you a period. And what you have to so in the thing is so you can say okay, but I forgot in doing that, I forgot the part that was coming from the polar part in the form. But what you keep from that is all the information about the residues, which actually are enough to tell you what the polar part was. So you get so the outcome in this case is not is a bunch of periods, one of them which is coming from the convergent part after you subtract poles, and another one which is the collection of all the residues that you had before of the polar part, so that you keep the complete information without that. And everything is somehow compatible with this arrangement of subgraphs inside larger graphs. Okay, so this all I want to say on this topic, but I mean the general idea, as I said, we're trying to find ways to think about these kind of problems in geometrically, and what are geometric methods for doing this sort of divergent integrals in algebra geometric ways, and obtain interesting periods out of those.
Just when you were talking about the procedure that you applied to your framework one, so
can you talk about the larger?
Sorry, you were talking about your procedure for defining the differential form, and you start with it defined as a rational differential form, but then in order to apply this result about it being represented in cohomology by the log of poles guy, you want to like maybe base it to C or something like that, and you commented that it might no longer be rational, but that wasn't a problem. And that your result would still be a period.
You mean
maybe I misunderstood.
You mean if I change the
Differential form that you end up integrating in the end has coefficients in C.
Right. So that's where the problem I was saying that it's a priori. I don't know. When I trade this differential form with an algebraic one, I don't know what will be the field of definition of that form. In general, the thing is, the variety themselves, I can control perfectly where they are defined. In fact, these compactification, they're all actually defined over Z. So as varieties, everything is under control. The tricky bit is that, indeed, when I change the form within the cohomology class, I cannot guarantee that the algebraic one will be algebraic over what? I mean, it could, it really doesn't have to be algebraic over Q. Now, I mean, there's something one can try to do, which I at some point started doing, and we haven't, we hadn't finished it at the time, is that you can try to construct more explicitly what this form with logarithmic poles would be that is in the same cohomology class as this one, and then try to see more explicitly what that is. And the thing is, there's some interesting. So these green functions of the Laplacians, there's some interesting integral kernels that are related to those forms, and one can use, and one can sort of try to build inductively over the graph. So I mean, and they involve some forms that are algebraic. So the idea was to try to try to actually build more explicitly this form with logarithmic poles that is in the same cohomology class and try to check that you never put in coefficients that are not rational. But you need that kind of argument, because otherwise a priori, so I mean a period is going to, it means it's going to be a period, but the problem is it's going to be a period over what, for varieties over what field. And because I mean a variety over Q, you can interpret it also as a variety over C, but then you know it's
if you don't know that it's coming from Q, then you don't know that the numbers it's outputting are special at all.
Right. So, no. Indeed, I mean, this is one thing that, you know, definitely from this perspective, from this approach, one needs to dig into more explicitly. You know, where is that algebraic form defined? You know, what field?
Any other questions?
Yep.
Sorry?
When you early on, you could reduce to trivalent, and. But you know, using a nice argument that didn't directly see the graph, and I was just curious: does it correspond to the obvious reduction to trivalent graphs, where you, with a higher degree vertex, you sum over trees that are consistent, trivalent trees that are consistent?
I mean, in the first version,
yeah, when you reduce to trivalent graphs.
That's right. The reason why I'm saying you can reduce to trivalent graph is just because if you have a vertex of higher valence, you're looking at the product of more than three harmonic functions, and you know, you can use these orthogonality relations to decompose. So there's a formula that allows you to decompose it into these triple products.
Yeah, so the question is, does that formula on Gegenbauer polynomials, does it correspond to, what does it correspond to graph theoretically?
Right,
what
that's
are you
right.
Doing
so,
graph
yeah, I think so. I think there is it does correspond to like opening up your n valent into trivalent things, and you have to sort of sum over the ways in which you can do that. So I think now at some point it seemed to me that it is kind of doing that. So it's
Any other
line? So you're saying that sort of trying to understand things most typically in configuration space was most easily done in four dimensions. Mm-hmm. And I guess in four dimensions there is this nice coincidence that 1 over p squared is 1 over x squared. And this is really the origin of dual conformal invariants. And so does that mean, well, your ideas only work for massless theories, or
yeah? So this is for massless, yes.
In that context, and it actually does fail in higher dimensions, does it? Or and can you make it work in higher dimensions, or can you make the ideas work in higher dimensions as well, or is it just for? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're saying that you can see the motivic structure only in four dimensions, or you can see it in higher dimensions, but it's harder.
You mean if for the
using configuration space,
right?
Using
X. So if I want to do for the in the mass case, or
just in the massless case still. I was just wondering if there's still some mm-hmm. something you could do in higher dimensions, mm-hmm. or the ideas are tied to four.
Yeah, maybe we should.
Well, yeah.
Any remaining of the comments?
Yeah.
Can you trace through and kind of see very practically what your renormalization procedure actually looks like in some, I don't know, example or something?
Yeah.
Atlas 5-4.
Yeah.
Maybe there's not enough time in the session period.
Okay. And we can continue the discussion.